So we are in 2 Samuel 3, and last time we were in chapter 2 of 2 Samuel, and remember that Israel found themselves underneath two kings now. They have David, who's king over just his tribe right now of Judah to the south, and then everyone else is under Saul's son, who we were introduced to as a son we'd never seen before until this last chapter, and that's Ish-bosheth. And he was made king over everything else. All the rest of Israel fell under him. And not surprisingly, when you have two kings in such a small country, war broke out. You know, there was a war between the two sides. And today we're going to see the conclusion to that war. And we're also going to get a contrast between those who are greedy and consumed with greed and those who are trusting in the Lord. We're going to see that contrast in the chapters we cover today. We're actually going to go through chapter 3 and 4. Chapter 4 is pretty short, so I think we can bring that in along with chapter 3. So let's go ahead and read from chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew continually weaker. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And the third Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmah, king of Geshur. And the fourth Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth Shephatith, the son of Abital, and the sixth Ithream by David's wife Eglah. These were born to David at Hebron." So don't hold me accountable to these name pronunciations. These are some pretty rough names in here. Get as close as we can, but you know, one of the things I've found as I've worked with people from Israel in my line of work outside of the church is that usually the way we think it's pronounced is not how it's pronounced. They pronounce things completely different than we think they would, even in our churches. So we just do the best we can and trust it to the Lord there. But we're going to see here, first of all, is the blessing on David. And David is that picture of the one who is not being greedy, but is trusting in the Lord. As I talked about, we're going to talk about greed and such. David's kingdom, we see, is growing stronger. That's what these verses are telling us. He's clearly winning the war against Saul's son. It says it was a long war. And we saw from chapter 2, verse 10, that Ish-bosheth's reign is basically 2 years. So probably the war was going on the whole time. So a 2-year war, that is a pretty long war, although we can think of longer wars in our own history. But a pretty lengthy war. And from previous studies, you know, we saw that David is God's chosen king now of Israel. Now Ish-bosheth is there, you know, not supposed to be, but he is. But David is still God's chosen king. And so it's not surprising that we see blessing on David. You know, God is basically accomplishing his will is what's happening. God is working on David's behalf here, and he's blessing his military so that David is going to be overall king, just as God said it should be, just as God appointed him. And so Ish-bosheth, you know, Saul's son, is watching his kingdom erode, is what's happening to his kingdom. He has the position of king at this point, but he doesn't have God's blessing in that position because he's not supposed to be in that position. It was just sort of taken by him. And sometimes, you know, people think that if I just have this thing or that thing, that my life is going to be great. You know, there's usually some possession or some position that they insert in there. If I just had this, everything in my life would be great. But I would submit to you that is not true. I mean, here we have the example of Ish-bosheth. I mean, he has the position of king, but he's not being blessed in it, is he? Because it's not God's will for him to have it. You know, if it's God's will for us to have it, there's going to be blessing in it. But when it's not God's will, it's not going to be blessed in the end. And, you know, outwardly things may look fine. People may think, oh, look at the, you know, position this person has, look at the things this person has, whatever it is. But inside, we know that it's not really satisfying. This is not really what I'm looking for, this thing that I thought I wanted, now I've got. The only real satisfaction for a believer is to be in the Lord's will. That's where we find satisfaction. And so, you know, even if our position doesn't look great, if it's the Lord's will, we will find blessing there from the Lord, blessing in our relationship with him, if nothing else. David is further blessed, it told us, with children. It lists all these children that he had. Psalm 127, verses 3 and 4 will sound familiar when I read it. Psalm 127, 3 and 4 says, "Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth." And David here we saw was blessed with six sons by his six wives. And the author lists all of them out there to illustrate the blessing. And actually, as we look at that, if you know anything about the future history of David's kingdom, you recognize some of those names and go, oh, this guy's going to be a problem later on. But right now, he's a blessing. You know, as a child, he was a blessing. He didn't have to go that other way, but he ended up going that other way. Because children are a blessing to us. Even in this case, that some of them, you know, are really all of these sons are coming in the wrong way. Because God doesn't condone multiple marriage for a king like this. In Deuteronomy 17:17, the king is told not to multiply wives. Kings should not multiply wives, which is exactly what David is doing. We see six wives here, and there's another wife that's not around right now that we'll see a little bit later on in our verses today. But you know, it's not these boys' fault that they came in the wrong way. It's not their fault that they came in the wrong way. And so they are still a blessing from the Lord. And it's a sign of God's blessing that God allowed these sons to be born. And the fact that David had all these wives does speak of blessing at the same time also. I'm thinking of Maacah, or Maacah, however you want to say her name, the daughter of the king of Geshur. Geshur was a kingdom to the northeast of Hebron. Remember that Hebron is in the south of Israel and Judah. That's David's capital right now. And this kingdom, though, is to the northeast of Hebron. And so she, no doubt, was given to David in forming an alliance with Geshur, is what this would be. That's why it points out that she's the daughter of this king. That was often what would happen. If they formed an alliance, there was a marriage involved in that to show the, you know, the sincerity and the depth of that commitment. And so we see from that that David's already being recognized in his region as a powerful king, because someone wants to make an alliance with him, you know, already, even though Ish-bosheth has all the rest of the territory. Now, Geshur was also, as I mentioned, to the north, and so this put it near Ish-bosheth's capital. Remember, his capital is in the north of Israel at Mahanaim. And so David's choice of this nation to form as an ally may show somewhat of a, you know, savvy move here in terms of, you know, kind of strategic to have an ally next to your enemy. You know, can be handy sometimes in times of war. But David is really receiving all these blessings from the Lord, is what we see. I mean, we don't see greed in David. Now, we do see this sin of him having multiple marriages, of course. I don't want to downplay that. But we don't see him being greedy, and that's why he has, you know, all this favor from the Lord militarily and so forth. But then there's Ish-bosheth. Life is not so good for Ish-bosheth. We're going to see, actually, as we continue now, the downfall of Ish-bosheth. The first problem for Ish-bosheth is that Abner, who is his, you know, number one guy, his military commander, right-hand man, all that, he gets out of control. He becomes out of control now. And we'll see that. Let's pick it up at 2 Samuel 3, verse 6. "It came about while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ish-bosheth said to Abner, 'Why have you gone into my father's concubine?' Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ish-bosheth and said, 'Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show you kindness, or I show kindness to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. And yet today you charge me with a guilt concerning the woman. May God do so to Abner and more also, if as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba.' And he could no longer answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him." And so Abner is out of control. As we saw last time, Abner is the real power behind Ishbosheth's reign. But now that power seems to have gone to his head. In the last couple of years, it's actually gone to his head. And he takes one of Saul's concubines as his own. And that, you know, in and of ourselves, we're kind of like, ooh, you know, or whatever, maybe. But there's more than just that side of it. It actually was how the successor of a king would show that he was boss now, is they would take their concubine and say, see, look, you know, I've even got his women or whatever sort of thing. And so that's what they would do. They would sleep with the concubines of the previous king to show that they're now the man that you should fear. You might remember from 2 Samuel 16 that this is one of the things that Absalom, when he temporarily takes over David's throne, this is what he does. You know, he does this sort of thing with David's concubines. And so it was something that was done at that time. And so Ish-bosheth confronts Abner on this. It's like, you know, what's going on here? You know, you took my father's concubine. I know what this means, you know. Well, Abner grows angry about it and sort of protests that he doesn't have any political motives here. Maybe just a lack of self-control. I don't know. But he tells the king, now that you've, you know, made me angry, I'm going to work to make David the king over all the land. In our last study together, we wondered why Abner made Ish-bosheth king in light of God's anointing of David. And he pretty much tells us here in verse 8 why. And it was out of his loyalty to Saul. You know, out of his feelings of loyalty to him, he goes ahead and makes him king. And remember that he's a relative also. So that, there's some of that too. It's kind of keeping it in the family. But now he's finally ready to follow where God has led, and that is to make David king over all the nation. Now, he has this expression here. He says, am I a dog's head? And it's kind of a weird expression. We don't know exactly what that means. It's only used here in the Bible, actually. But using a dog reference like this in the Bible typically expresses a lowly state for someone. It's sort of a put down. And so whatever it means, it's not favorable. It's as though Abner is saying, am I just like worthless? You know, is that what I am here, you know, in your kingdom? Well, next we're going to see that Abner, in his, you know, taking over control here, now is going to follow up on his threat, and he's going to pledge all of Israel to follow David. Let's read from 2 Samuel 3, verse 12. It says, then Abner sent messengers to David in his place, saying, whose is the land? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel over to you. He said, good, I will make a covenant with you, but I demand one thing of you, namely, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see me. So David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, to whom I was betrothed, for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her as far as Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, go, return. So he returned. Now Abner had consultation with the elders of Israel, saying, in times past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines, and from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. And in addition, Abner went to speak in the hearing of David and Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel, and the whole house of Benjamin. Then Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron. And David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Abner said to David, let me arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may be king over all that your soul desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And so Abner here is pledging all of Israel now to follow David. And notice how in verse 12, Abner just assumes authority now to speak for all of Israel. In chapter 2, he yielded power to Ish-bosheth, but now he's done pretending. He's like, let's not pretend anymore. I am the real power here, so I'm just gonna do this myself. And David is happy to make a treaty with Abner. Remember that David once fought alongside Abner. They were in the same military under Saul. And that was before Saul became jealous of David and ran him out. And so David knew Abner well, and we can assume that he trusted him more than Ish-bosheth, most likely, as a result. But David has this one condition. He wants his wife, Michal, back. You might recall that although this will make his seventh wife that we've seen in our text today, she was actually his first wife. And that happened in 1 Samuel 18. But Saul took her away from him. And that happened in 1 Samuel 25, actually, we saw where she was married to someone else. But they never actually divorced. I mean, David still legally was married to her. And so he says, I want my wife back. You know, I mean, send me my wife back, you know. And so, again, though, even though that she's going to be reunited to David, we see heartache in the life of Michal. She's not had a great life, really, when you look at all that's happened to her. The man she's married to now, she's been married to for probably about 12 years, as my calculation goes, because Saul, took her away from David when David went on the run. David was on the run for about 10 years, and now there's been about 2 years of war, so that's like a dozen years that they've been apart. And that's a dozen years she's been married to Paltiel, who obviously is completely heartbroken that his wife is being taken from him like this. Now, some people debate as to whether David had a right to reunite with Michal. I think he did have the right to reclaim her as wife because she was his wife. They never divorced. It's not his fault that this other man foolishly married her when she was already married to him. But then others say, well, why did he choose to do this? I mean, he could have just left her with the second husband. Was it for love that he did this, or was it a political move to form a connection with their tribe? She's of the tribe of Benjamin. She's Saul's daughter. And so by him demanding her back kind of says, look, you know, look at the feelings I have, you know, for the tribe of Benjamin. I want my wife, who's a Benjamite, back with me. Try and get on their good side, as it were, in unifying the kingdom. Because you imagine that Benjamin's going to be the hard sell, you know, for them to give up having the kingly line to go to David then. Well, we don't know for sure what David's motives were, but we know certainly that Abner was working to unify all of Israel here, and he works with the leaders of Israel in this. He does all this diplomatic work on David's behalf, going to all the different tribes, going to the tribe leaders and talking to them and getting them to pledge their allegiance to David to ensure that they're going to do this, they're going to follow through with this. And he references in verse 18 a prophecy about David, that David's going to defeat the Philistines and so forth. We don't actually have that prophecy recorded, and so it's kind of uncertain where this prophecy came from that he's referring to, but we actually see it does come true in 2 Samuel 8, verse 1. It talks about David defeating the Philistines and protecting them from them. In verse 19, I think it's interesting and obvious. It's going to be obvious why he does this, but it singles out Benjamin as a tribe that Abner went to specifically. And as I already said, this was the tribe of Saul. And so clearly, again, they're the ones less likely to be interested in yielding power to David, who's of a different tribe, who's the tribe of Judah. But they also side with David over their own kinsman, Ish-bosheth. And for one thing, this tells us, boy, he must have been a rotten king, right? I mean, he must have really been terrible that they have no problem with this. But it also illustrates that the whole nation was recognizing God's anointing of David. It's such a beautiful thing that they're all seeing that. Okay, yeah, David is clearly the one chosen. We've been watching this war. David is just, you know, totally, you know, kicking tail here, as they say, if that's okay, I can say it from the pulpit. And, you know, it's obvious that, you know, God is on his side, not on Ish-bosheth's side here. Well, finally then, Abner, in verses 20 and 21, he's kind of closing the deal, and so he comes and meets with David, and he says, okay, now I'm just going to go do it. You know, I'm going to leave, and I'm going to get everyone together. They're going to come, David, and they're going to anoint you as king. Now, we've already talked about how Ish-bosheth has lost control of Abner, and that's a big problem for him. But now it's going to get even worse for him because Abner is going to be killed. And I'll explain why that's worse for him in a minute. Let's read from 2 Samuel 3, starting at verse 22. "And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him arrived, they told Joab, saying, 'Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he has gone in peace.' Then Joab came to the king and said, 'What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why then have you sent him away, and he is already gone? You know, Abner the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you, and to learn of your going out and coming in, and to find out all that you are doing.' When Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah. But David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside and into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard it, he said, 'I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. And may there not fall from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, or who is a leper, or who takes hold of a distaff, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread.' So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon." And so all those things, he says, the leprosy, the discharge, all that, he says, let there not fail from the house of Joab one who has these things. I think I read that incorrectly the first time. And so in these verses, Joab shows a couple reasons potentially for his murder. The first, it's very clear in the text that he killed Abner because Abner killed his brother, Asahel. We talked about that, I think that was last time we were together. Remember that when Asahel was chasing Abner in the battle scene, Abner was pleading with Asahel to turn away from him. He kept saying, "You know, don't follow me. You know, I mean, how am I going to face your brother? Basically, if I kill you, you know, I mean, Abner was the superior warrior. Asahel was just faster, it turns out. And well, that's what ends up happening. Asahel won't turn aside in his pride and his foolishness, and he's killed by Abner." And so revenge is the clear motive here. You know, revenging his brother, Joab kills Abner. But commentators suggest that there's also some jealousy mixed in here also about Abner, between Joab and Abner. I mean, Abner has done what no one else could do. I mean, he's a big man right now in Israel, isn't he? Look at what he's just done. He's bringing all Israel under David. That's a pretty big accomplishment on your resume in front of David there. And so naturally, David is going to feel some indebtedness to Abner. I mean, he's already thrown a feast for him when he came to town. And that might have moved him to the top of David's trusted advisors. You know, Abner, this man I've known for, you know, most of my life, who just accomplished this amazing thing in Israel to bring everyone together, you know, just as God intended. And so Joab's position, you know, Joab basically has the analogous position to Abner in David's kingdom. And so he might have felt like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here, you know, if this guy comes into our kingdom. And so maybe he saw him as a rival. And so as a second possible motive there, he killed him rather than allow him to come into David's kingdom like that. I mean, he wasn't going to have an easier shot at him until, you know, after this, because right now they're not really united yet, you know, so he could still say he was an enemy. But once they come together, you can't say that anymore. Now you're on the same side and it's just murder. Now, I said that, you know, Abner's death was going to hurt Ish-bosheth. Now, why would I say that? I mean, because Abner actually was kind of working against Ish-bosheth. We've already said that. He is taking the kingdom away from him and giving it to David. But at the same time, Abner was a real force to be reckoned with amongst the side that Ish-bosheth is on. And what we're going to see next is after Abner is gone, those who remain are kind of emboldened now, and they actually assassinate Ish-bosheth. something that they probably would have been afraid to do when Abner, this fierce warrior, was there standing beside Ishbosheth, you know, kind of protecting him. You know, he was under his protection. Well, now that Abner's dead, that's gone. So let's skip ahead to chapter 4 real quick. And we're going to see in 2 Samuel 4 that Ishbosheth is killed. Now when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, and all Israel was disturbed. Saul's son had two men who were commanders of bands. The name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other Rechab, sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, of the sons of Benjamin. For Beeroth is also considered part of Benjamin, and the Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been aliens there until this day. Now Jonathan, Saul's son, has had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled, and it happened that in a hurry to flee he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. And you can just tuck that away. That's a little foreshadowing about Mephibosheth. We'll see more of him later in 2 Samuel. So the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, Rechab and Baanah, departed and came to the house of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking his midday rest. They came to the middle of the house as if to get wheat, and they struck him in the belly, and Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. Now when they came into the house, as he was lying on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and killed him and beheaded him. And they took his head and traveled by way of the Arabah all night. Then they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Behold, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord the king vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants." And so, as we've talked about, Abner has died now. Now these other lesser military leaders, these sons of Rimmon, who would have reported to Abner, they would have been underneath Abner because he was the top guy. Well, they see Ishbosheth in his weak state. They see him in a vulnerable position here. And like everyone, it's obvious that Israel's now going to follow David. And so they say, hey, let's murder this guy, you know. And maybe this will give us some, you know, a good footing with David then. Let's take his head as a trophy to David and show him what we've done for him as we've murdered the king. But they miscalculated. Let's read verse 9 then of 2 Samuel 4. It says, David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, when one told me, saying, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth?" Then David commanded the young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. And so David is not pleased by this act of murder, like he did with the Amalekite who claimed to kill Saul in chapter 1. He puts these guys to death too. He put that guy to death, he puts these guys to death. And, you know, we read that he removed their hands and feet, and we think, why did he do that? That seems kind of bizarre. And the whole point of removing those and then putting them and then hanging them up on a wall like this was to publicly shame them and show that, you know, basically this was really bad what these guys did. You know, we don't tolerate murder like this. And so we've covered a lot of ground today in these verses. There's been a lot of ugly stuff in these verses, unfortunately. But let me stop and extract a principle in these verses in which we saw a lot of greed going on in various characters in these verses. Because greed leads people into all kinds of evil. We think, first of all, of Abner. You know, Abner seemed to be greedy for the throne, and so he took one of Saul's concubines in that greed. And then he took the power from Ishbosheth, really. I mean, it's like before he was at least propping Ishbosheth up. Now he just sort of takes the power away from him, says, "I'm really the number one guy here," and ends up being killed then as a result, actually. I believe that Abner, like these other people, was actually looking for a place in David's kingdom. You know, that's why he's doing all this. That's why he's doing all this grandstanding. He's going to all the tribes, and really in total disrespect of the king. I mean, you think he would involve the king in this, like, you know, he's going to have some important role of helping bring this about, you know, and heal the nation and all that. But no, he's working out all these deals on his own, you know, and then goes to David directly also. So it looks like he wanted to roll in David's kingdom. He's like, this one's not working out. I need to get into the next one, you know, is what he's looking to do. And just when his pride would have been at its highest point, it seems like he's had a complete victory in this coup that he's doing. Well, perhaps in that pride, that's what hid him from the danger of Job's invitation. I mean, he's a seasoned warrior. He knew that Joab was not going to be happy that he killed his brother. And so he should have known, this is dangerous for me to, you know, meet with this guy like this. But, you know, pride does make a person feel indestructible. You know, when someone's full of their pride, they feel like nothing can bring them down. And that's not true, but they feel that way. And so perhaps he reasoned that I'm so important, he couldn't possibly harm me. You know, what's David going to do to him if he touches me? There's no way he'd touch me. That'd be insane. Well, not so. You know, Joab kills him. And so when all his dreams seem like they were coming true, he ends up dying instead. But then we think about Joab as someone who shows potentially some greed here also. Remember, we theorized that part of the reason he killed Abner was that he saw him as a rival and as a threat to his position there under David. And so if that is true, he murdered this man in this way. Anyway, you slice it, he murdered a man who was on a mission of peace. I mean, the guy who was trying to reconcile the nation, and you murder him. I mean, that's really terrible. And we haven't read all these verses yet, but one of the things that we're going to see is we'll read a few more verses in a minute, is David doesn't administer justice on Joab. He lets him live. I mean, as harshly as he's judged all these other guys, oh, you know, you killed this guy in his bed, you're dead, you know, or whatever. Doesn't touch Joab. And it's really kind of difficult for us to read that. But first of all, remember that Joab is David's nephew, as was Asahel, who was killed by Joab, or excuse me, was killed by Abner. Now, that doesn't justify partiality. You know, I mean, that doesn't make it right because he's in his family. It gives us maybe a little understanding, but doesn't make it right for David not to judge him in the right way. Because we're going to see that David actually keeps Joab on. You know, he continues to be a trusted advisor for a long time, you know, through his reign and all. Secondly, though, David actually seems like he's afraid to touch Joab. He's afraid of what will happen if he touches Joab. Let's read from chapter 3, verse 39. David there, at the end of some verses, we'll read it we'll read completely in a minute. He says, I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. And so the sons of Zeruiah are Joab and Abishai. And, you know, he's afraid to touch them, with what it appears like. I mean, no doubt they had a strong following amongst his army. I mean, they were the leaders of the army. And so we saw actually when Asahel died, who wasn't as strong of a leader, that everyone who saw it in chapter 2, they stopped and stared. You're like, oh, this is terrible that he died. So imagine if David tried to take out Joab, who's the military leader, he's afraid of what will happen if he does that. And so David just leaves it with God. He says, I can't touch this. I'm going to leave it with God. And this is not really a great example for us of someone, because of their relation to the king and because of their position, getting away with murder. It really is just a failing on David's part. There must have been a better way to handle this, but it wasn't done that way. And it displays somewhat of some hypocrisy there. But it actually, at the same time, shows the humanity of David. I mean, that David was imperfect. You know, he wasn't, the Lord walking on the earth. He was just a man that the Lord was using. And it also shows that the Bible has true history in its pages, because there's no moral to this story. This is a bad thing that happens here. It's a bald-faced failure on David's account. And so if you were writing a good story, you never would have it in that way. You know, you would have some way to, you know, reconcile and not just kind of leave us on this, ugh, you know, why did this happen? And so it shows that it had to be recorded because this is what really happened. You know, this is what really happened in the end. David made a blunder. Finally, as examples of greed, there's Baana and Rechab, what we just read about in chapter 4. They clearly were looking for a position in David's kingdom. They're looking to get favor from David, and they think that killing his rival will guarantee them that, you know, that that's going to get them on the ends with David. But their greed and their selfishness, you know, that led them to murder a man in his own bed, just ends up having them put to death. You know, that's what they find instead. Instead of getting what they greedily thought they get justice. And so I'd submit to you that greed is still a problem in our world today. I don't think I have to work too hard to convince you that greed is still alive and well. We see it in our homes and in our schools and workplaces and certainly in our government. We see greed is at work there. People who want for themselves and don't care who else is harmed in the process as long as they get what they think they want. The Bible tells us as believers, we're not immune to greed either. Let me read from James chapter 4, starting at verse 1. James 4, verse 1 says, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures." In other words, your motive is greed. That is why you're asking for it. Now, you know, as a younger Christian, I wasn't so sure that the source of all my quarrels was greed like this. But, you know, as I've grown and grown up in age and all that, when we really like start to look at the quarrels in our lives and the quarrels around us, I mean, we typically find it, this is what's true, you know, that greed is at the source of it here and these desire for pleasures. We too, as believers, must be on guard against greed and against selfishness because, you know, greed is so deceptive. Greed often disguises itself as though we've been morally wronged in some way, that we're being denied something that we deserve is how we feel. I think about this quote from the Charlie Brown Christmas story that was just on TVs and everyone's DVD players probably recently, where one of the characters, Charlie Brown's little sister, says this. She says, "I just want what's coming to me. I just want my fair share." And isn't that what we say in greed? Is that I just want what's coming to me. We think, well, I deserve this. But in reality, it's selfishness, you know, and it's sin. Proverbs 27, verse 20, the second half of the verse, Proverbs 27, 20 says, "The eyes of man are never satisfied." You know, we can always desire more. Instead, though, the Bible tells us we don't need more. What we need is contentment with what we have. From 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6, let me read there. 1 Timothy 6, starting at verse 6. It says, "But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content." And I think David had discovered this secret of contentment. I think he was illustrating that in these chapters. This is why he could wait on the Lord for what the Lord was going to provide, instead of chasing after even things God had promised. I mean, you don't see David overly strategizing militarily against, you know, Ishbosheth and all of that. It just seems like this war he's allowing to grind out instead of trying to go in and kill the king himself and take it over. No, he's upset when someone kills the king. That's not what he desired. And so we've seen the end now of Ishbosheth. You know, his reign is over. We've seen a lot of evil deeds in these chapters. And the question is there any good in these scriptures today? You know, is there any good things that we see there? So let me draw out some good things that are in these passages. One is that we see the sovereignty of God in these passages. we see a lot of evil going on, but through all this evil that's perpetrated willingly by these various characters that we've read about, we see God's will is still accomplished, right? I mean, David now, when we come to chapter 5 next time, is poised to become the overall king of Israel. And that's exactly what God's will was. You know, God is working that through all of this. And David, again, was waiting for this by God's hand. He wasn't taking it in his greed. But we see how God is able to work in such a way that even though all these people were making their own free choices and doing these things of their own will, he still accomplished his will through all that. And it's amazing that God is able to do that, that he doesn't make us robots, but he still accomplishes his will through our individual actions and choices. It can only fill us with awe of who he is, that he can do that. It's just truly amazing. Next we see, though, as another positive thing, another good thing in these verses, we see David's right heart in all these things. We already saw his dealing with the killers of Ish-bosheth. As I said before, he had no intention of harming Ish-bosheth. That was not David's goal. David wanted peace with the man. He didn't want this man to be murdered. And though David was destined to be on the throne of all Israel, he wasn't greedy to take it, in contrast to all these others. Finally then, let's look at this, the last verses we haven't read today from chapter 3. And this is David's lament for the death of Abner. So 2 Samuel 3, starting at verse 31. It says, "Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, 'Tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth and lament before Abner.' And King David walked behind the bier. Thus they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. The king chanted a lament for Abner and said, 'Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen.' And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was still day. But David vowed, saying, 'May God do so to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down.' Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner the son of Ner to death. Then the king said to his servants, 'Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil.'" And so David, in his lament for Abner here, he fasts for him. And it talks about there, one thing I'll point out in verse 31, it talks about him following the bier, which whatever that is, we're asking ourselves. Well, basically, it's like an open coffin. It was sort of like a couch or a mat that they would put the dead person on and carry them to the tomb. That's what that thing is. But David fasts and David mourns and David causes all the people to mourn. I love how in verse 31, he even says to the killers of Abner, he says, "You need to, you know, Joab, you need to tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth, you know, for this man you just murdered. You're going to mourn him now." And so David has all of them mourning for this man. And he makes very clear through all this that he does that he had no part in Abner's death. And everyone understands that. And the people see all of this and they're blessed by that. You know, they're pleased with who their new king is and for the people of Judah, who their existing king is. How awesome it is to follow a ruler who's a righteous person like this. You know, you can just feel their, you know, just their, that joy they must have of knowing this is a good guy who's going to be our king here. No more of this Saul stuff, you know. Now we got someone who really walks with the Lord. This is awesome. I mean, if think about on the flip side, if David would have made this murder look like it was okay or even celebrated it, you know, that would have probably brought a lot of fear into the people. You know, I was like, what kind of society is this? Someone who is as powerful as Abner can be murdered, and there's like, no problem. You know, we don't see any problem with this at all. What hope is there for me as a common person? You know, no one even knows who I am. You know, they can knock me off anytime they want to. But David's is going to be a righteous reign as king. It's going to be so different than what they've experienced under Saul. His reign is not going to be established by violence or sin. It's going to be a righteous reign. And, you know, the world today still mocks at a heart like David's, you know, this pure heart he had. But the Lord is pleased with a heart like David's. And I pray that our hearts will be pleasing to the Lord as well, that we'll have pure hearts toward God and other people as we trust in him. We trust in his strength for our provision, not being filled with greed and looking for what we can get out of this world, but trusting God as David did, and being content with those things that we already have, and waiting for God to bring any blessing into our life that he decides. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord God, we're just so thankful that you are the God who brings blessing into our lives. And sometimes hard times come into our lives as well, but we know that your hand is not absent there either, that you're working in our lives and you have a plan for our lives. And we just thank you, God, that you are sovereign over our world and in our lives. And we praise you that you bring good things into our lives. And we praise you that you, in your word, you illustrate what greed is for us so that we're not taken by surprise and we can recognize its temptation and we can be freed from that as we lay that out before you. We just ask that we would have those pure hearts before you like David, and that our lives would be a witness to you like David's was a witness. In Jesus' name, amen.